tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. Syrian forces advanced in the northern city of Aleppo Sunday in an ongoing offensive to wrest one of the country's major cities from opposition fighters. Syrian state media reports the army promised rebels safe passage if they cleared out of the city's eastern sector following bombing campaigns that have heavily targeted the area's hospitals. Relief workers say the largest remaining Syrian hospital in the rebel-held eastern half of Aleppo was bombed Saturday for the second time in recent days as Syrian government forces and their Russian allies pushed to recapture the entire city. The New York Times reports U.S. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump declared a $916 million loss on his income on his 1995 income tax returns. The newspaper said the substantial tax deduction could have allowed Trump to legally avoid paying any federal income taxes for up to 18 years. The Times said the nearly billion-dollar loss was large enough to eliminate more than $50 million a year in taxable income for 18 years. The newspaper said it had consulted tax experts who saw nothing illegal in the Trump tax documents that took advantage of the tax provision. Responding to the report Sunday, Trump tweeted, "I know our complex tax laws better than anyone else who has ever run for president and am the only one who can fix them." Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton speculated at a presidential debate that Trump had not released his tax returns because they would reveal he had not paid any federal taxes. This is VOA News. Hungarians cast ballots on Sunday in a referendum on whether to accept plans by the European Union to resettle asylum seekers among its member states. Prime Minister Viktor Orbán wants to stop the influx of large numbers of Muslim migrants into Europe, arguing they threaten Hungary and Europe's Christian identity and culture. He spoke to reporters after voting.
We are proud that we are the first. Democracy is something which must be reinvented again and again. And in many countries, people think that referendum is or could be against the democratic decision-making system of the parliament. But there are questions and issues when the voice of the people is necessary. So it's too important to be decided only by parliament, parties and government.
Under the EU scheme, Hungary would receive approximately 1,300 asylum seekers. No votes supporting the government position are expected to win, though there is uncertainty whether turnout will exceed the 50% plus one vote threshold of registered voters needed to be valid. Several dozen people were killed in Ethiopia's Oromia region when police fired tear gas and warning shots to disperse anti-government protesters at a religious festival. The tear gas caused panic and triggered a stampede Sunday that killed at least 50 people. Without giving a specific death toll, the government confirmed several people died and others were injured in chaotic scenes during the annual festival in which the Oromo community marks the end of the rainy season. Colombians decide Sunday whether to accept a peace deal between the government and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, FARC. The referendum comes 6 days after a final peace agreement between the government and the National Guerrilla Movement it was signed, bringing an end to the longest-running insurgency in the Western Hemisphere. The British Prime Minister says Britain will formally start the process of leaving the European Union by the end of March 2017. Theresa May made the announcement Sunday and spoke at a speech at the Conservative Party conference.
We're going to talk about global Britain. Our ambitious vision for Britain after Brexit. Because 100 days ago, that is what the country voted for. We're going to talk about Britain, in which we are close friends, allies, and trading partners with our European neighbours. But a Britain in which we pass our own laws and govern ourselves.
That's British Prime Minister Theresa May. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
That Mr. Kabila is in the last term of his mandate. So he has to leave the power. He didn't organize elections by purpose.
The chairman of the Electoral Commission of the Democratic Republic of Congo announces plans to delay elections until 2018.
The police believe that we can only achieve success at this poll when all stakeholders in the election come on board and see the elections through the same spectacle.
The Ghanaian police call on stakeholders, including political parties, to urge their supporters not to engage in violence during the December elections.
We actually grown so timid not to actually stand up for the truth. And as long as we remain like that, then there is no way we can bring the politicians.
And three Zimbabwean students tell President Robert Mugabe the sharp unemployment rate among university graduates is unacceptable. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Political parties boycotting talks between the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo and other opposition groups plan to meet on Tuesday. This to kick against a decision to delay the elections scheduled for this year. Local media reported that the chairman of the Electoral Commission revealed at a closed-door meeting on Saturday that the elections will be delayed until 2018. For a reaction regarding the new election calendar, I reached Albert Fabrice Puella, a leading member of the opposition Party for the Renaissance of Congo.
We cannot accept Mr. Kabila to stay in power even more than one day after the 19th of December of this year. We cannot accept, because it's a big violation of the Constitution. We cannot accept. We know that Mr. Kabila is in the last term of his mandate, so he has to leave the power. He didn't organize elections by purpose. So we can't grant him by staying in power two more years, not only according to my political party, but according to the dynamic of opposition and the resemblance with Mr. Etienne Tshisekedi and his all opponents, the real opponents, where we are holding a meeting this Tuesday, all of opponents, and we give our position, but we know that we will call our population to resist.
Don't you think the Electoral Commission needs time, because it said so, to organize the census and then upgrade the voters' register? They just got new equipment. Don't you think that they need time in order to organize free, fair, transparent, and credible elections?
For sure, they did it by purpose. That's not organizing elections so that Mr. Kabila can stay in power. They didn't want to organize elections in time, because that Mr. Kabila wants to stay. Okay, if we can let Mr. Kabila, then we can let electoral commission to take time to organize the elections, but without Mr. Kabila, without him, but not for more than 1 year. The Constitution said that we can organize things just in 4 months more. For elections, not to have another term for the president. No, we can't have successful.
What can you do about it? Because the Electoral Commission chairman is saying that they cannot organize elections now until in 2018.
What we can do for the time being is to tell to Mr. Kabila, your time is up, you have to go. He goes, and we will set up another chairman of Electoral Commission, because Mr. Nanga is someone who belongs to the Kabila's party. So we want another one to lead the Electoral Commission so that we can have a real fair election. For the time being, Mr. Kabila, the 19th of December, he has to go. and we'll organize elections without him. We'll find someone else who can lead the country for just a little time, just to organize elections.
What are your views about the current ongoing talks? Because this announcement was made at the ongoing talks between the government and other opposition, in spite of the fact that some opposition people are boycotting it. This basically will be the normal practice which will allow President Kabila to stay on till 2018.
We don't want Mr. Kabila to stay even one day more. He has to go. Constitution allows only 2 terms for 5 years. So, only 10 years. But Mr. Kabila stayed in power 16 years, so we can't accept him to violate again the constitution by staying in the power. We cannot accept. If, according to us, Mr. Kabila has to go, and we're going to organize elections in 6 months. But the Electoral Commission is doing what is good for Mr. Kabila. We know that they can do the recruitment of electors just for 4 months if we can have all the DMCs and all equipment for the election. But they want to get more time so that they can allow Mr. Kabila to stay in power and killing people, violating human rights, and we cannot accept it. Enough is enough.
Albert Fabrice Puela is a leading member of the opposition Party for the Renaissance of Congo. He spoke with me from the capital, Kinshasa. The Ghanaian Inspector General of Police has been holding discussions with all stakeholders in an effort to ensure a peaceful election during the December 7 polls. For more about the elections, I reached police spokesman Cephas Arthur in the Ghanaian capital, Accra.
The police believe that we can only achieve success at this polls when all stakeholders of the election come on board and see the election through the same spectacle. And we decide to chart a peaceful course towards the election. That is the reason why the Inspector General of Police is leading the police to dialogue with all these stakeholders. And today I can say that we met the National Peace Council to discuss the way forward in this election. We have met with the traditional rulers. We still have a few more stakeholders lined up to hold discussions with. And it is all in our bid to ensure that we all come on board to ensure a peaceful election. And we are calling on them to also influence their followings to ensure that they don't engaging in any act of rowdyism, vandalism, hooliganism before, during, and after the election.
Now, Cephas Arthur, last time the police came up with setting hotspots around the country where they are monitoring to ensure a smooth electoral process. Now, concerns have been raised in the past, or some called people who try to create chaos and confusion in those areas. In terms of intelligence gathering, to be proactive to arrest some of these situations on the ground, what is the current situation, or what is the police working on at the moment to ensure a successful general election without violence?
Yeah, thank you. Because of some factors, some historical and others current, the police have identified certain areas that we call hotspots, that we think that these places are susceptible to violent activities during the election. And we did this identification of these places with a view to putting measures in place to quell them or neutralize such status that they have acquired. And so as I speak, a lot of measures have been put in place. The first one being intelligence. Our intelligence officers have already been deployed to these areas to pick pieces of intelligence so that we can assess them and work by them. That is one. We also have other security arrangements that we have devised that we implement during and after the election, so that we can also manage the elections and ensure that there is peace.
What is the working relationship with the Electoral Commission ahead of the December 7 general election, particularly in areas where reports of incidents of ballot snatching? What is the working relationship to prevent all these kinds of shenanigans?
Yeah, thank you. The police has a very cordial working relationship with the Electoral Commission. And in fact, we also compare notes such that they also did some identification of some hotspots. And they seem to be tallying with what we also did. They did it on a constituency basis, and we did it on a police station basis. And they seem to coincide, to tally with each other. And as I indicated earlier, we are sharing notes a lot. We are comparing and working together. We have met to discuss the way forward. They have put on the table their concerns about security, and we have also put on the table our concerns about their activities, in fact, their arrangements of issues. And we have agreed on a middle course. We have agreed on issues that will safeguard the integrity of the election for all of us. And we are working together, not only with the AEC, but with other stakeholders, as I mentioned earlier.
Sefas Arthur is the spokesman for the Ghanaian police. He spoke with me from Accra. Three Zimbabwean students have become an overnight sensation after protesting in front of President Robert Mugabe. They said they sacrificed their lives to highlight unemployment problems faced by thousands of graduates. The University of Zimbabwe student Tondurai Dumbo, Tembenkosi, Rashwawa, and Alexander Mukumba were criticized by High Education Minister Professor Jonathan Moyo, who says their actions were ill-conceived. One of the three students, Tondurai Dumbo, spoke with VOA Zimbabwe Studio 7's Gabes Dube about their protest.
I just saw that the outgoing president of the SRC, and also a graduate in being part of the graduating class, I should just confront the chancellor on behalf of our students and tell them that what we really need a job and nothing much. We don't care if we lose until cows come home or whatever, but at least there should be jobs. So we need to just tell the chancellor, also being the president, that please make sure you provide jobs, because we need the message. So I had to raise a placard during the ceremony.
And what was the reaction of the police?
The police did nothing, but the presidential guard are the ones who actually took me from the, pulled me out from the crowd and when questioning me and asking me a bit, asking who was sponsoring me and everything. But I don't need to be sponsored to realize that things are difficult. I just told them the truth. The biggest is a central police station where we spent the night and only to be released at 1:00.
What happened at the police station? Were you beaten up or whatever?
No, we were not beaten up once we were at the police station. They charged us with, they say, criminal nothing.
So now, what does it mean for you to become an overnight sensation in Zimbabwe for what you did?
I was really not looking at becoming an overnight sensation, but it said that we actually grown so timid not to actually stand up for the truth. And as long as we remain like that, then there is no way we can bring the politicians to book or to become accountable to the people. So it was all about saying, look, we as a team, we can't remain silent. The government of the day should actually be brought to book, to be questioned, to actually deliver on certain things, because we cannot continue down this way. And if the youth remain silent, then we are doomed, because the youth of yesterday took action and they won in the team. But equally, the youth of today should take action.
So, looking at the issue concerning jobs in Zimbabwe, do you think that graduates will ever get employed with the situation as it is today?
as it is today, there is no prospect of getting any employment anywhere in Zimbabwe unless you know someone who is influential enough to get you recruited, maybe by the civil service in Zimbabwe. Those who went before us, who graduated since 2008, haven't even gotten a job.
So now, do you fear for your life after protesting during the graduation ceremony?
To be honest, in a way, I feel under pressure and also a bit worried what will happen to me. But you know what? When you did that, I wasn't even expecting to be alive today, speaking or doing anything. So equally, when I took the decision to do what I did yesterday, I equally knew that it might be the last thing that I do before I join my sisters. So I'm not worried about being the youngest and sister. It's time to be killed. It still happens. Because after all, there is nothing really which I can say I have to try hard to save my life. Yet the life that I'm living is miserable at the end of the day. Because already we have lost our lives as the youth to the greedy leaders that are in charge. So in the end, I've already lost.
Tondorai Dombo is a student at the University of Zimbabwe. He spoke with VOA's Zimbabwe Studio 7's Gibbs Dube from the capital, Harare. According to new figures released by Action Aid, an international NGO, women are working an average of 4 years longer than men. This is due largely because of their greater role in housework and caring for children, the sick, and the elderly. These findings are part of a new ActionAid study into how countries are preparing to meet their promise to tackle gender inequality as part of the UN Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs. Zakaria Sambake is responsible for advocacy and policy at ActionAid Senegal. For VOA reporter Alpha Jallo asked him to explain the significance of the report.
The significance of this study is to look at the progress made by the countries, from the countries of the United States that have approved the SDGs, the 17 SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals, in September 2015, to achieve it by 2013. So one year of that anniversary, so we have conducted studies to look at the progress made by countries in 14 countries, including Senegal. And in Senegal, we have focused on specifically on two major objectives. The objective 5 about gender equality, and also about objective 10 about inequality. And what we have, the result of that study show that Senegal is still not ready to achieve the SDGs, specifically on that two specific objectives. And that may mean that Senegal government and all the development agencies need to make efforts to really focus on women's livelihood, women's well-being.
Okay, great. Now, women have made much legal progress over the past 4 years in Africa. For example, progress in providing women and children with more primary, secondary school. How has that affected women's progress overall?
You know, what we have noted with this research is that, we are just observing that women are making progress in that sector. But all the effort they are doing have at least impacting also in the development sectors, like the work they are doing, really they are the poverty, they are getting more and more poor. So that means we need to make progress really to increase the budget that have been allocated for social protection, and to look at specific needs for women. Senegal have 6% or 6.5% of growth, but at the same time, the poverty is also increasing. It means that we have the income, the resources are here, the income is here, but we are not redistributing this. What we call is to really think about these policies to redistribute the incomes and really to make it really participatory approach that can also take into account women's need, children's needs, basically the society needs.
Your organization, Action Aid, how do you improve the economic well-being of rural women? Is it simply better training in agricultural techniques?
Yeah, training is one of the components that we use to really build the capacity of women, because it's very important. It's really basic things we need to really see in the ground, specifically with to addressing these issues. But it's not enough. Training is not enough. But also is to support them, to help them to organize, to really know they need also to challenge the powers, but also challenge the policies. If they know that accessing to seed is something that they have a right to access to seed, they have a right to access so all the other means, or also if you say they need also to have this training also to fight against violence. And because the policies are in place, but the practice are not in favor with them. So just also training can give them more tools to develop the advocacy plan, the advocacy work, to go to see the mayor, to go to see the ministries, to go to see the parliamentarians, to go to see the president.
That was Action Aid Zakaria Sambake. He spoke with reporter Alpha Jalu in the Senegalese capital, Dakar. Meanwhile, as global efforts to tackle world hunger continue, the debate on the role of genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, especially among African countries, still rages. Edward Mabaya, a Zimbabwean-born agricultural economist, is the associate director of the Cornell International Institute for Food, Agriculture and Development. For VOA reporter Ruben Chiama asked him to explain the situation in Africa.
Let me just start by saying the context of my work is more in the seed sector in general. I've done some specific research projects that focused on the potential for GMO crops to improve food security in Africa. As you might know, GMO is a very divisive topic. There is a lot of people who have dug in on both sides of this debate, in the US and in Europe, being on polar sides of this debate. When it comes to Africa, Africa unfortunately seems to be caught up in this big debate between the Europeans and the Americans sometimes, and African governments are caught in this middle where they're trying to decide what is good for their own particular citizens and their own their seed sectors, for example. My take on this is that GMO is one of those technologies that has been out there. Right now, it's been out for more than 20 years. We have not had any incidents, and there's a fairly strong scientific consensus on the safety of GMOs. You know, for anything that has been published out there has proven that these are fairly safe. But unfortunately, there is something out there that can be best described as kind of the fear of the unknown, that people are still very skeptical about this. I think that people, you know, have a reason to be skeptical. We have to be careful about what we eat. But after a while, you have to ask yourself how much evidence is adequate to prove that a technology is safe. So my take on this is that Africa has a serious food security crisis, and we should not throw away any tool before we try it out. We are currently in a world where we're facing new challenges in terms of diseases, climate change, shelf life of products. All these things are things that are going to require very cutting-edge scientific technologies to be able to solve. GMO is one of them. It's not the only one, and I believe that it should be considered just like any other technology.
Maybe you can share or shed some light. What are the most type of crops that we are talking about in Africa?
So, unfortunately, this is where, you know, most of the public are very ill-informed about what is out there in terms of GMO technology. It turns out when you look in Africa, only 4 countries have commercialized GMO crops. That would be South Africa, Egypt, Burkina Faso, but mostly these have been for maize in South Africa, and soybean, and the rest of these other countries has only been for cotton. So outside of that, there's no tomato out there that is GMO. There's no chicken out there that is GMO. There's no fruit out there that is GMO. So it feels like it's very limited adoption so far in Africa. It's only been in these particular countries, and in most countries, it's still very much in confined field trials. So it's not widely adopted. So where we are here in Kenya, there's no commercial crop on the market that is GMO, or anywhere in East Africa for that matter.
Some critics also say that GMO crops means farmers will have to purchase new seed every year, and that means it's an expense to the more older farmer. How would you respond to that?
So there's two ways to respond to that. One of it is just the factual correction. So there is something called hybrid crops. This is where you take two parents that are different and they produce a seed that gives you vigor and higher yielding. when you plant that seed back in the soil, you cannot use that seed again. That is very, very distinct and separate from GMO technology, where you're using genetic engineering to come up with new traits.
Edward Mabaya is the Associate Director of the Cornell International Institute for Food, Agriculture and Development. He spoke with Ruben Chiama in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from African Collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In football, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, has announced that its president will be limited to 3 terms in office from next year's election in March 2017. According to Junior Binyam, CAF's media spokesman, the new ruling was approved at Thursday's Extraordinary General Assembly. It's a major change for the governing body, whose incumbent president, Issa Hayatou, has been in power for 28 years. The limit will also apply to the members of CAF Executive Committee. In February, football's world governing body, FIFA, limited its presidency to 3 terms in office as it aimed to recover from a corruption crisis. In 2015, CAF voted to change the statutes, which previously stopped officials serving past the age of 70, which paved the way for Hayatou, who turned 70 in August, stand in the next presidential election. He has yet to announce if he'll contest the election. Meanwhile, Kwesi Nyantachi and Almane Kabele Kamara have been elected to fill 2 new Confederation of African Football seats on the FIFA Council. Nyantachi is president of the Ghana Football Association, and Kamara, from Guinea, is a CAF vice president. They will complete the 7-member African delegation at a meeting of the expanded FIFA Council in mid-October. The meeting in Zurich should begin talks to expand the 2026 World Cup to 40 teams and start the bidding process. Still in football, a Malawian female referee is blazing new ground after officiating at major tournaments like this year's Olympics in Brazil and FIFA Women's World Cup. Reporter Lameka Masina has her story.
Bernadette Quimbilanzika's passion for refereeing started when she joined the Malawian army as a soldier 16 years ago. As a soldier, she used to attend football matches.
At that time, the only thing I knew about football was the offside thing. So when the assistant referee raises a flag and then there's this referee who puts his arm up, whistle, point the other direction. So I was so much interested with what the referees were doing.
A mother of 2 who now works as a secretary in the University of Malawi had to attend a refereeing course for beginners where she earned a grade 3 refereeing certificate. She has now been officiating matches for 14 years and she has risen to the top of her field at both local and international levels. This year, Quimbilanzika became the first Malawian female referee to officiate at the Olympics. Last year, she became the first Malawian to referee at the FIFA Women's World Cup held in Canada. Also, last year, she was voted the best assistant referee for Malawi's top level Super League. In 2013, Quimbilanzika scooped up the best referee accolade for the Confederation of African Football Elite A referees course for males and females held in Egypt.
Of course, I wanted to get far with Football Association, but to be honest with you, there was not even a single day I imagined myself officiating at the world's biggest football event like the World Cup, the Olympics.
She owes her success to the adherence to the rules of the game.
As a good referee, you don't have to pretend that you haven't seen something when you have clearly seen it, or to make your own rules. Where it requires a yellow card, you have to caution that player. Where it requires a send-off, you have to show that player a red card.
She says being a female football referee in a country where soccer officiating is dominated by men, she endures insult from soccer fans every time she steps on the field of play. She says some people tell her to officiate netball, one of the most popular women's sports in Malawi. She expects this, however, and says, "I do not give it a damn." Madali Sopil is a sports editor at privately owned Capital Radio. He says he has long following Kwimbila Senzika's style of officiating.
I can't remember any games that have ended in any kind of controversy, be it violence, so that the teams were not happy with some of the decisions she made. So it speaks volume that this lady knows what she does.
Kwimbila Senzika, who is 35 years old, says it is her wish to maintain her reputation as a good referee until she retires, probably in 5 years' time. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Zomba.
Thanks, Lamek. Finally, in athletics, Kenya's Shadrack Bet Korir and Viola Jepchumba set new course records to win their respective races at the Cardiff Half Marathon. Korir won the men's race in 1 hour 54 seconds, taking almost a minute off the previous best in the Welsh capital. The Kenyans dominated both elite races, with Korir followed home by countryman Cyprian Katut and Charles Muneria. Jepchumba, meanwhile, beat compatriots Flomena Daniel and Lena Jerotich. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Did you ever think that you would be the switch? Did you ever think that you would have the hits? Did you ever think that you would be the Don? Have a tree with the 50-acre line? Be the switch. Did you ever think that you would have the hits? Did you ever think that you would be the Don? Have a tree with the 50-acre line?
Yeah. I never ever thought that I would be right here today. You helped me face my greatest fears and conquered all the hits. And now I'm getting money, now I see your love is true. And everything I got today, I owe it all to you. See me now, you know the young boys wanna be me now. All the bad belly people wanna see me frown. No, 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 no. Yeah, they wanna see me drown. I know one day I go wear the crown. But girl, get low, 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 low. I'm going back, but never. Lady, I'll be together. I promise you, my brother, oh, we gon' be rich forever. I never ever thought that I would be right here today. You helped me face my greatest fears and conquered all.
Did you ever think that you would have the hits? Did you ever think that you would be the Don? Have a career with a 50-acre line? Yeah. Be the switch. Did you ever think that you would have the hits?
Did you ever think that you would be the Don? Have a dream with the ticket in the line, yeah.
Forever, backward, never. Made the enemy up together. And you know the motto, new school things, and we gon' be rich forever. Forever, backward, never. Made the enemy up together. I promise you, my brother, oh, we gon' be rich forever. God, today, we owe it all to you.
Everything better, oh my sweet potato.
in my life, yeah. Everything better, that's why me I call you. Oboro tata, kambido na afuge na anya. So bebe tell me, gine kecho. Oboro big glue, okwa Mr. Raw. One, eh? Toya pack ya. Kambune guche, you know I like ya. Kima nuche mode nebi no so relax ya. Kamye gidi kosi, eh? Iota go. Otute zibu hene mezi nandum. Sosa di kama, no bi chandum. Before me, I've been the hustle with red eye. Till you came into my life with NGOZI. Eborana in the better. Asama Biate Mobi. Now let me tell you what the truth is. Any day me spend the rest of my life with you, please.
My one and only. Baby, since you came into my life, yeah. Everything better. Oh, my sweet perero. Baby, since you came into my life, yeah.
BLE, double SRN to the G. Couple of other girls, no fear them. Them they shout, I know they hear them. No. So pin up Ungwa Bulugaba. Well, Ugaba, Munagigo de Bibi Daba. Also, good in that sale, no fa Kologaba. Kologaba, I'm Munagigi Birigaba. Abia,
why you mobi ma?
The Holano,
why you jamano?
Oh, bebe,
why you mobi? Why you mobi? Shadio, me, I like you, die. Shadio, me, I need you, die. I go kill. My life, yeah. Everything better. Oh, my sweet potato. Baby, since you came into my life, yeah. Everything better. That's why me call you. Baby, you're a plus. I call you my baby. Yeah, that's why me I call you. Cause it's your cool. I want to hold up, baby, the way you fire. Story
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Developments in South Sudan last week would suggest that its people are awaiting a nasty, brutish, and short existence. This is really regrettable because since its independence, the people of South Sudan have not enjoyed the fruits of their liberation and independence. The real problem is this. The political class, and one should include people of the military in it, have miserably failed the people of South Sudan. We have seen conflict after conflict among members of the political class. And the reality is that South Sudan is engaged in a power struggle for ethnic superiority. If the truth be told, in many parts of Africa, the leader of a country finds ways and means whereby his ethnic group emerges in major positions in the country. This phenomenon has been challenged in South Sudan, and that is the reason mainly for the various disputes. Fortunately, the regional group and the African Union recognize this situation, and they formed a very important solution, which is to have a national unity government of the two major factions, hoping that at some point the matter will be resolved by the people of Sudan in an election format. But this phenomenon of seeking ethnic superiority is so strong that they would not allow the national unity to survive. The upshot was there was serious fighting in South Sudan, and the first Vice President, Riek Machar, was actually chased out of the capital. And it was just fortunate that the United Nations was able to rescue him at the border, and he was taken to Khartoum, Sudan, for medical attention. How ironic, because those who know Riek Machar very well will know that he spent most of his life fighting against the Sudan, and now he has been driven to seek succor in the Sudan. Also, there has been a naive approach for what I will call a quick fix solution, believing naively that if one should only remove Riek Machar from the fray in South Sudan, in Juba, that everything will be okay. Now, those who propose this solution may not realize that the backbone of the fighting in the Sudan against the government of Sudan during the civil conflict are people like Riek Machar. So there is no quick fix solution. There is no solution without trying to bring in the faction of Riek Machar. The United Nations has done its best. It has decided to deploy an intervention force to Juba, and that force should not only provide security, but to create the environment for the restoration of trust between these factions. That should be started. That should be the next approach, not to abandon one faction, but to bring them together and to ensure that they work together, because otherwise the problem will be for the people of Sudan. And we have heard from again Khartoum that the Riek faction has announced it would be engaged in a military confrontation with the government of Sudan. The victims will be the people. So this is the time for the international community, including the African Union, to redouble the efforts to help restore the national unity government. I thank you.
That was one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. I hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if the kernels are not finished, the jaw will not rest. I'm your host, Peter Clotta in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On September 23rd, at a Lake Chad Basin side event at the UN General Assembly, the United States pledged an additional $41 million in funding to meet emergency needs for conflict-affected and vulnerable households in the Lake Chad Basin. This additional funding to UN and NGO partners will ensure tens of thousands of people receive critical humanitarian assistance, including emergency food assistance, safe drinking water, and shelter support, as well as interventions to address acute hygiene, nutrition, and protection needs. According to the United Nations, there are more than 2.5 million internally displaced persons and more than 169,000 refugees living in the Lake Chad Basin. During the Lake Chad Basin side event, the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, highlighted the pervasive food insecurity in the region. Ambassador Power stated that the crisis is so severe that an estimated 134 children will die every day of severe malnutrition in Nigeria's Borno state unless treated. And this is just a sliver of the consequences if we come up short on raising enough funds, she said. The United States has now provided more than $359 million in humanitarian aid to this region since 2015. The United States continues to be the largest donor to the area. At the recent high-level meeting, donors pledged $163 million of the $542 million needed between September and December. In addition to the U.S., major donors include Belgium, Italy, and Britain. The United States urges other donors to fulfill their pledged contributions and consider donations of additional humanitarian assistance for the millions of people in the region whose lives have been devastated by Boko Haram's senseless violence.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.